All right, today I'm in London with Brad Barry, senior odds compiler and risk manager at Ladbrokes for some years, 15 years. So tell us to begin with, what did that job entail and how did you get there?
Well, how I got my interest in racing, probably like a lot of other people, you know. My family weren't involved in racing, no, nothing along that lines. I was working in a restaurant when I was 18, and one of my best friends at the time, his father ran the seafood stall at Slough Dog Track. I think it was Tuesdays, Thursdays and Saturdays. So if we went along with Bud, helped him unload the jellied eels and the cockles, we got a lift in, free entry and a lift home. And his seafood stall was at the apex of the last bend, so he was a fair old judge on the dogs. And so we used to go get in there for nothing and go round to the main ring. And it was just like a different world, you know, having a £30 to 10 called down to friend by Dudley Roberts or something. You felt like you were part of, you know, an inner circle. And a couple of winners, because Bud was a good judge, stopped at the Dolphin on the way home, or the Double Century for a beer. So got through my interest, you know, through greyhound racing initially. So I think it was the same year as the Ballyreagan Bob Skirlo Champ show down at Wembley. And this was in a time when pubs and restaurants weren't open in the afternoon. They shut between 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock. And so if I was working in the restaurant, you'd have that sort of 2 hour gap where there was nothing to do, ended up in the betting shop sort of thing. Small betting shop in Garston, just outside Watford, a Ladbrokes shop. Ended up punting in there. Decided one day that we were going to go to Ascot, first time I ever went racing. We'd had a last winner on the Thursday in the betting shop. And then we said, like, let's go to Ascot. First time I've ever been to the Royal Meeting in the Silver Ring. And I think, as so many people say, if your first experience of going is a successful one, then you're hooked for life. And we had no luck in the first three races. Last three races, it was Lester Pickett on Never So Bold. I think it's a King Stand Stakes. Steve Cawthon rode a horse called Protection for the late Jim Joel. And then last race came along and we had all that I'd won. It's probably about 100 quid in those days, which was a week's wages effectively, on a horse called Valuable Witness for Pat Edry, Jeremy Tree horse for the Niarchos family. And it's funny, I remember the bookie I had the bet with, a guy called Gus O'Neill. You know, I don't know how you remember things 30 years ago, so I couldn't tell you what I had for dinner last night, to be honest. What did I have for dinner last night? No, I genuinely couldn't tell you. I mean, but, and we must have been 1.5, 2 furlongs out on the rail to see Pat Edry come past, you know. I know you probably remember that horse, you know, fantastic stayer. So I was interested, that was it, I was, you know, hooked for life. Got to a point where I thought, well, I was spending all my money in the betting shop, maybe it'd be easier to go and try and get a job working in there than earning it in the morning and losing it in the afternoon. And an opportunity came up in that same betting shop that I'd been punting in, just to go and do a correspondence settling course as a trainee manager. I was marking the board in the old board marking in the town centre in Watford. And yeah, learnt to settle via they used to send you a list of questions. You'd fill them in, send them off, they'd send you back again, they'd mark them, you send them off, they'd send you back again. Unbelievably long-winded when you think about it now, but you know, I could probably still settle an equally divided flag or something like that if the push came to shove and you gave me a pencil and paper and enough time. So sort of got my foot in the door there. Worked in the betting shop for a couple of years. I had a great supervisor at the time, a guy called John Murphy, and probably a lot of my progression in the company is, you know, was down to him, because he could see I had an interest in racing. I was going racing every day on my day off. He said, why don't you try and price some races in the evening? So I used to be one of those guys that got the Timeform Black Book and the results from the Weekender and that kind of thing. Sat down and tried to, you know, got the Sporting Life out and got my ruler and my black pen and marked off the runners for the next day, and tried to sit at home in the evening and price a couple of races, see how I compared to other, you know, the real prices and the real odds compilers the next day. So that sort of piqued my interest. He saw that I had an interest and said, look, why don't we try and see if we can get you, you know, a job at head office or a job in the trading department or something like that. And this guy, John, he was friends with a chap called Peter Michaels, who was a well-respected and well-known odds compiler and did a tissue for a lot of the industry. And I managed to get an interview with Mike Dillon for a job in PR, actually, as it was at the time. Went along to the interview. Be fair to say, it didn't go very well. I wasn't the type of person that Mike was looking for, but he could see I had an interest in racing, and I just got a job. I thought, let's try and get myself into the head office, get my foot in the door. And I got a job in PR for literally a month, worked in sales for 2 months, and then got seconded down into the trading room, what was then called the Operation Control Centre, which was where the bets and the business from the shops came into via the phones, and that was relayed into the trading room. So that was my sort of foot in the door in trading, as it were.
So you were there when, because I was working on course, well, just after that sort of time, and the money would come flooding in from Ladbrokes. I mean, were you there when those decisions were being made?
Where I was working at the time was next door to the dealing room, as it were. So that was where all of those decisions were made, in the dealing room. I moved from the Operation Control Centre in what was called Antipost. So that was a room that had like 5-6 guys in sometimes at the most. And that's where the prices were actually compiled. So for advert races, and we would provide a form card every day between us, a guy called John Thompson, who was in charge then, who was like a doyen of the odds compilation and anti-post department. And I sort of, you know, learnt at his master's knee, as it were, at the time. We would provide a card for trading. Trading would use that card, as many other things, and make those decisions as to the sort of business that would, you know, be sent back down to the tracks.
Yeah, because people of a certain age won't know that back in those days, there was only very few races priced up on the day-to-day racing. So you'd have marked the cards up for your own use, for reference against what was actually going on course when the market became live.
Yeah, so we actually used to produce for each meeting, for each day, one of us would be assigned to that meeting the day before, and we would produce a card for every race, with comments on and everything that was required for the trading, for the dealing room. And the dealing room would use that card and the other knowledge that they were given, and they would make the decisions. And we'd price up the advert races for the next day, 2 or 3 or whatever it might be, depending on the meeting. And as you say, maybe 6-8 races on the day of the events for early price business.
Right, so there you go, Brad. Price up the 3:30 at Newton Abbot tomorrow. Where'd you start?
Well, yeah, you start with the runners, and time form ratings would be the first thing we would look at. We, you know, use the black book. I used either super form or race form. For me, I preferred super form. And you would make a decision on distance. Had the horse run over the distance before? Had it run at the track before? Ground was obviously a crucial factor. You look at its previous runs, and then you just build a pattern from as much information as you could, you know, you could decipher. Different people do it different ways. I used to try and work out what the shape of the race was, would be my first thing. So is it a 5-to-1 the field? Is it a 2-to-1 chance? What was it? Try and find out what price you think the favourite is in this kind of race. Not only price, but factoring in the jockeys and the trainers, and also knowledge of what the punters are likely to be looking for. So I'd start with the favourite, then look at those that you thought had no chance, and then, you know, the others fitted in between. I don't think there's any right way or wrong way. Everyone, you know, did it differently, but that would be how I'd start. That would be my sort of my starting base. If it was an early price race, more than one person would do it. So you might have 3 or 4 people pricing that race, and then you'd have the dreaded call over. And if you were the office junior, which I was, obviously, when I first went in, you inevitably got shouted up, it's your turn to give out your prices first. So you'd go down the card, 6-to-1, 8-to-1, and then, you know, the more senior guys would give their prices out. And if you were suddenly going along and you were under the odds, everyone, you knew you was going to get to a point further down the card where you're going to say 5-to-1, and they're all going to go 3, 11-to-4, 5-to-2. So, you sort of, you know, you were learning the hard way. But you know, you're learning from these guys. And there were some great people in that office. John O'Connell, who is now a, you know, successful racing TV pundit. I sat next to Ed Chamberlain for a year while he was doing his BHA graduate course. He was in there, odds compiling. Paul Smith, Derek Smith's son, obviously, as you know. A lot of, well-known faces and well-known people passed through there at the time, learning, from scratch, how you do it from the beginning kind of thing.
Right, so how much would it be, literally look at it and do it all on the figures, or would you say, oh, hang on a minute, he's a bit of a tricky dicky, we better go in a bit cautiously with that one, or would it all be just, these are the facts and figures, these are the prices?
You'd initially price it on the form. So it sounds quite antiquated now, but we used to literally have a video recorder set up on the TV, and it would be the office junior's chore to put the cassette tape in, and every single race was recorded. Piece of A4 paper on the little counter on the screen, writing down the number. So we had every race that was run every day had been recorded. So if we wanted to reference any of them, or if Mike Dillon came in and wanted to see something on one of the races, you could reference it, go back and look at it. So we would price it initially on just the form. Then you can add in your factor, this trainer does really well at this track. Like lots of people, trainers are creatures of habit. So you'll find a trainer has often run one of his best horses in this race previously, or they always use this race as a stepping stone for another race, so it might not be. And then you'd look at jockey bookings. Everyone would want to be with, Dunwoody or Maguire or whoever it might be at the time, Pat Hedry or Steve Gawthon. So, that's another factor that you take in. So you'd start with just the form, and then you'd put in all those other factors. And like you say, you get horses that people are just looking out for, jockey-trainer combinations that people are looking out for, Mark Johnson at Goodwood or whatever it might be, So that's always shaving a couple of points off or a point off, but at the same time balancing it percentage-wise with the other runners.
So a bit surprised there. So even back in the early days, the races were recorded, so you had access. Most people would have had access to videos, would they?
No, we recorded every single race. It was a laborious task. Whoever was sitting nearest the TV.
Yeah, but even for like off meetings at Newton Abbott or something like that, would that all be recorded?
If we could see it, we would record it.
Oh, right, got you. So So before, it would have all been just on the form, same as everybody else in the, unless it was. Okay. So fast forward into modern times, obviously, most people assume that skills accrued by guys like you are pretty much worthless now, because the night before somebody goes up on the machine and then the market starts to settle down, and it appears to the general public, the betting public, as if all you do is look down through and see the Betfair prices and add a bit of margin and then go with that. How true is that?
Well, I'll be honest with you, I've been out of horse racing odds compilation for a considerable number of years. I was much more involved in sports betting for the majority of the last 15, 20 years. So how they do that now, I couldn't give you a 100% accurate answer. It certainly wasn't something, Betfair wasn't around and the exchanges weren't around when I was doing horse racing. So, but as far as sports betting is concerned, it does have a massive effect. It does make a massive difference. It's why you see the same set of prices from every firm on something like a test match coming up. If it's 2.5 England on Betfair, there's not going to be any bookmakers of a 13-8. It's as simple as that, it had a massive effect and still does, definitely.
Okay, Brad, so we talked in the last part. So you're doing the sport, you're pricing up a cricket match. Now, would you price up that cricket match well in advance of the market on the exchanges going up?
Well, originally, obviously, when I first got into sports betting, there was no exchange. So you could price it up and put the prices up, and it didn't make any difference because no one was ringing up straight away to bet 6-4 because they could lay 11-8. It just never happened. So obviously, things were a lot different there. When I started sports betting, it was a price for Bjorn Borg, a price for Nick Faldo, and a price for Eric Bristow, and that was probably, you'd done your sports betting for the year. The big changes were obviously the internet, because this was, pre-internet days when I started doing it. So one of the problems you had was, where did you get any information? Where did you find out what the runners were? Where did you get the scores for the overnight golf in America? You get the first half a dozen on teletext the next morning. So actually finding out anything was difficult. And as golf as an example, we used to have to phone the PGA Tour or the European Tour and get them to fax over entries. Use the ATP Tour media fax service for tennis entries and draws and things like that. So actually just getting any kind of information was, you know, it was pretty difficult. It's actually made me laugh recently looking at how people were talking about how slow the shot tracker was on PGA Tour and it hadn't updated. And I think back to, well, yeah, you used to get an update the day after you'd find out what the scores were, sort of thing. You know, literally you'd wait. And now people, if you haven't got the scores within 5 minutes, they're getting upset. So it was difficult to get any sort of information to start with. And for example, on the cricket would be priced up at the test match. You'd have top batsmen and the win-draw-win market, as it were. And it'd be priced up before the match, and then it'd be priced up again at lunch, and then again at tea, and then at the end of the match. And there was no where do you get your comparison from? You know, you didn't have another firm's prices on your phone, or you didn't have Betfair, or, you know, almost pre-computer. So you didn't matter. You put the prices up as you saw them and laid the bets. And another part to that was you couldn't even see the bets coming in anyway. You know, because there was no like tracker or ticker or recording of the bets. You put the prices up and they were out there. So, you know, you weren't so worried.
There must have been occasion in those days where firms totally disagreed and there was an arbing situation available to the punters.
Yeah, but arbing wasn't a thing. Well, you know, how did you find out the punter what the price was unless you went into the betting shop or on page 401 on ITV on the text or whatever? And you might get someone that was backing England at 6-4 with you, and, you know, Pakistan at 5-1 somewhere else, but, you know, you wouldn't know, and it didn't make any difference, really. You know, you just had the confidence in your prices, and sports betting was such a tiny fraction of the market then compared to what it is now that, you know, it's a lot easier to get bets on as well.
Now, you've been up until recently, very recently, so you've been in the modern situation where there are people trying to nick a few quid arbing and stuff. Now, what's the issue that bookmakers have with arbers? Because if you spent all that time pricing up the cricket and somebody's trying to nick a few quid off of you because the exchanges disagree slightly, should you really stick to your guns and think, well, that's the price, they're wrong, and take them on? Or, you know, or is it just the fact that bookies don't like people earning out of them?
There's probably a little bit of yes in all of those things. Let me try and give you an example. If, say, you were pricing up a tennis match between Henman and Rosetsky, and you made it an each or two game, you were 10 to 11 each, and someone else was 1-2 Henman, 6-4 Rosetsky. So you're getting filled in on Henman at 10 to 11, they're getting filled in on Rosetsky at 6-4. And the match goes two sets all, six games all in the fifth set. It's an each or two match. Your prices are definitely right. If you priced it again tomorrow, you'd still be each or two. But the guy that you were 10 to 11 on, Henman, ends up winning in the, you know, the end of the fifth set. So you've done all your money because you've laid the 10 to 11. They've done that. They've kept all their money because they've laid the 6-4. You've done your money not because you were wrong, you were right. You've done your money because somebody else was wrong. So there's a little bit of that factor in why you don't want to lay, you know, arbers, as you'd say, because there's a chance you'd want to lay both sides. You want to lay two-way business, not just one way all the time. If you're ultimately trying to make a book, whether it's on the cricket or the tennis or the, you don't want to be filled in on one side. You want to be, you never get those books where you get the perfect situation, but ideally you want to be in a situation where you've got a balanced book, where you've made a book. And obviously there's a little bit of the, as you say, bookmakers don't like just having, you know, their pockets picked by people who, to their mind, might have, you know, no skill or no judgment or no, I don't mind if someone is taking me on at my price and they're better judged than I am and they win money off me, that's fine. But, you know, just to be, you know, there's a little bit of pride in that. You don't want to just be giving money away from someone who's literally picking your pocket.
Okay, so that's interesting. So we're talking about sports betting still. So you price, they're fairly static, all your figures and facts are there. You've priced up, this for argument's sake, the cricket. Now, if you suddenly see on the exchange a sustained move on one of your prices, do you look to adjust the market or see what news you've missed that must have filtered through? Or do you think, nah, you know, back to the thing, they're wrong, I'm right, let's take a few quid out of this because I think they're betting bad value?
Yeah, I think you'd have to, if you want to use cricket as an example, you have to say, what's the match? You know, is this a test match between England and Australia? Well, yeah, I've got an opinion, and every bit of news that I think is out there is available to me, whether it's the weather or injury or team news. If you're confident that you've not missed anything and nothing's passed you by and it's a big game, absolutely, yeah. If it's, you know, an IPL game or something like that where you're less confident that the market may perhaps have more information than you have, then you wouldn't be taking an opinion. If the market moves, then you're moving, because unquestionably the market will know more than you do. So you just have to judge each situation and each the strength of the market and the strength of the competition that you're betting on. Is it a test match or is it Basildon under 13s cricket league? You know, you're making your decision judged on the liquidity and the strength of the market, and you're quite happy to be wrong on the test match if you know you thought England were a superior team and you're happy to lay them, or you're happy to keep them on side, and you're wrong, fair enough. But you don't, you know, you can't have as strong an opinion on every single market in every single event.
Okay, now going back to what sort of sports trading again, you were in that period, in the thick of it, the big bang, I call it, of the exchanges. Now, when I worked on course, it took a fair while for people to start cottoning on to the effect of the betting exchanges. How long did it take for you guys to start taking them seriously from your end?
I think sort of, you know, it's not for me to speak as a spokesman for Ladbrokes, but I think, if I'm honest with you, there was such an animosity towards Betfair and, you know, a desire that they weren't going to succeed and that everything would be done to try to, you know, level the playing field, as was often the well-used hackneyed phrase at the time. They were a bit slow. We were all a bit slow to accept the power of, you know, the behemoth that became Betfair. For me, as a odds compiler and a punter, I think the thing, I'm going to use an analogy that I saw a TV program once on the BBC. It was a documentary about ticket touts, and they were talking about ticket agencies and ticket touts, and they said the worst thing that happened to ticket touts was eBay, because they bought a ticket for Phantom of the Opera for 25 quid and could knock it out for 100 quid. But when eBay came along, you could buy it, someone could go on there and buy it for 50 quid. And I remember the guy saying on this documentary, suddenly everyone knew what the right price was. Everyone knew what the price for a ticket was. And almost that was the case once Betfair came along and became very liquid, that suddenly everyone knew what the right price was. So it made it harder for us, harder for me as a punter at the time, because obviously everyone who's involved in racing is a punter, where I thought I had an edge, where I thought I knew what the price for something should be, and the punters might not through any nefarious or skullduggerous kind of thing, but because that was my job, that was what I was being paid for, suddenly everyone knew what the right price was, so there was less of an edge as a layer or a punter.
Now, did it take the heat off the bookmakers a bit, because all the real shrewdies were now going on the exchanges tucking up the absolute mugs on there? Did it for a period, you stop getting the really sharp money coming in?
I think if you make a mistake, the sharp money will still find its way to you, whether that's on the racing or the cricket or the golf or the snooker or the tennis or anything. You know, I think there are still plenty enough opportunities out there now, and even more so because bookmakers now obviously are pricing up so many markets and have so many derivative markets that are driven by trading tools and algorithms and robotic programs, that you can't be as confident in all of your prices as you might have been if you're the person actually compiling that price. You know, if I've done it and I say it's 5-2, I know it's 5-2. But if it's a derived market off of something, you can never be as confident in that. So, because whereas you might have had 20 markets on a golf tournament, you now might find you've got 100 markets, or, you know, 250 markets on a football match. So while you have to get 250 of them right, as a punter, you only have to find the one that's not right. So there's plenty of opportunities out there, and the sharp money, Betfair or not, will still find its way to you if you're the wrong price.
So do you think that algorithms would eventually take over from odds compilers, or does there need to be a human touch there saying, oh, this has got this a bit wrong here?
I think One of the problems that punters would say is why they have a lot of difficulty getting on is because of that there are so many markets and so many derivative markets, and you can never, as I've said, be as confident in, you know, in all of those prices as you can in the ones that you've done yourself. But if, let me use this as an example, if you had to get on a plane and there were two planes on the runway and they were both going to be flown autopilot and the computer was going to take it off, fly it and land it, one of the planes still had two pilots on just in case and one didn't, which one would you be getting on? You know, it's kind of the same. As many robo programs and as many trading algorithms and as many tools that you can have, you still need someone there to take it off and land it at the start of the event and at the end of the event, and to watch it just in case something goes wrong. So I think that obviously individually you can't provide as many markets as you can if you're using trading tools, and that's quite right. You want the best of technology and you want the best equipment and the best programs and the best tools that you can have, but you still, I think, need someone who has got that knowledge of the market, who can spot things that might not be quite right, who can start it and finish it and make sure it doesn't crash into the mountain, I suppose.
So it's like a perpetual battle. You think there's some very clever people on the other side of the exchange using similar software and coming up with, you know, they've decided to be the punter rather than the bookies. You're surprised by how clever the other side is?
I'm not, because I've sort of gone through that period of, you know, the prehistoric dinosaur type days of how we used to do things with a pencil and paper to seeing how it's done now. I can see there are, when trading teams now and trading firms are looking to employ people into their function, everyone wants people with maths degree. If you look at any of those kind of trading jobs or jobs within the industry, people want quants, people want people who are excellent at Excel and have got fantastic IT skills. More so, that's more of a requirement than someone who's got good bookmaking skills. I hope, you know, for the future, for my future as much as anyone else, is that there is still a desire and a need and a requirement for someone who knows the difference between, you know, 6 to 4 and 13 to 8 kind of thing.
A word that I've only recently, in the last 10 years heard, for somebody that works in a bookmaker's telephone centre or whatever, is a trader. Now, what is the difference between a trader and somebody that just answers the phone and puts the bets in the book at the price that's advertised?
I think there's plenty of people out there that would say, yeah, that's one of the finest questions you've ever asked. I suppose it's a fancy term, isn't it? A part of the trading that I did when I was, you know, in sports betting, what you would call as a trader, is you're compiling the odds to start with, you're making the markets, you're getting them displayed and put out there, you're taking the bets and you're seeing the bets come in now. So you actually have trackers where you can see all the bets that are coming in, and then you're adjusting your market according to the field book and according to the changes in the exchange betting and what the punters are after. So to some degree, that's what you are doing. You are like listening to what the punters are saying. Once you've set your prices, ultimately they're out of your hands to the degree that the punters then decide. They decide what shortens up and they decide what goes out. Using golf as an example, because it's something that I was mostly involved with for the last sort of 8 or 10 years, you'll get tipping lines and you'll get blogs and you'll get people on Twitter and, you know, trade press. All of those things affect the market, so you have to be on top of it and you have to be adjusting prices. Now, I would never shorten something up just because it was tipped up somewhere. I'd want to still lay the price, and I would never shorten it up just because it was shortening up on the exchange. I'd still want my share of what my prices were. To what degree you have the confidence to lay those prices depends on the market and how good your boss is, I suppose, if you're a trader. I mean, I was fortunate to work with some people that for a long time that had a lot of confidence in what you were doing and would back you. And if you went to them and said, this is why I want to be this price and this is how much I want to take out of it, if you had the right reasons why you were doing it, I mean, I don't know why I should want to burden myself by dragging it up, but Tiger Woods, Hoylake 2005 was my nemesis. It was the, you know, the worst time for me in my 30 years of of trading. He'd come into the tournament not playing fantastically well, but particularly with the driver, he was hitting it pretty wayward. The forecast was quite bad. All the stories were the rough was quite long. So we decided to take Tiger on, 6-1. And I'd been to my boss and trading director and said, this is how we want to do it. This is how I want to do it. And he backed me. And, you know, we laid some serious bets, you know, plenty of five-figure bets. And we were happy to take them on. I won't go through the dreadfulness of it in case I start crying. But he hit one driver all week into the rough and still made birdie. It was as dry as you like. The fairways were wide. There was hardly any rough. He was hitting it straight down the middle with three irons and stingers. And he went on, won by a couple of shots. We'd been clear top price at 6-1. We'd done £3 million. You know, and I think if it wasn't for the fact that I had such a good guys who were my bosses at the time, Patrick Jay and Mike O'Kane, that would have probably been the end of my tenure at the company. But yeah, thankfully we got past it. But yeah, you still have to take an opinion, and when the time's right, lay the bets.
Well, golf betting is very popular, so I want to stay on the go for a bit. One of my previous interviews, Jeremy Chapman.
Yeah,
so looking at the same form book in inverted commas as you,
yeah,
similar to the racing. Yeah. So Jeremy obviously sees quite a lot that other people don't see, given his prowess for tipping winners. What factors would you be looking for? You can be as anoraki as you like about this, because people are interested in golf betting. What would you be looking for when you're pricing up? What positives?
Well, let me say now, for golf punters, it's never, you know, it's a real utopia for them now. There's so much information online available. When I first started doing it, to getting that sort of information, we used to have to keep manual sheets of, you know, form and previous week, years, golf weeklies. You drag out the last 5 years of a golf weekly magazine that had that tournament in. But now there's so much information of course form, current form, and there's so many tools and predictor tools that for a punter, if you go online and look up, it's a free, loads of them are free. There's some paid sites, which is absolutely fine. You know, people putting in a lot of work, and you know, why should they give their information away free? But there's plenty out there that you can get. Every single piece of information you need to know is out there. So the type of course it is, the course designer, whether players have won in a certain month of the year, greens in regulation, strokes gained. You can build your own predictor models and put in as much information as you want. Course form, current form, they're the two big factors. But then you're factoring in what are the punters going to be looking for. That's where your sort of skill, I suppose, as an odds compiler comes. As an example, you'll get someone who's played really well and you've watched him the previous week and he's 100-1 shot and he's played quite well and you've noted it and you've seen him, you know, if he hit maybe hold a few more putts, he could have been up there, but he sort of crept up the leaderboard, improved every day. Then you look at next week, he's in a similar field, same sort of standard of field, but he's a player you want to keep on your side. And then you look at the course form and say, oh, it's actually, he's got three top tens here in the last 5 years. And oh, he's played well on Poana or bent grass before. And suddenly you factor in, you're seeing four or five different things. So you say, oh, well, I was going to keep him on my side at 50. I might have to go 40 here. And then you see another bit, and suddenly you think, well, everyone's going to be looking for this guy, I know now, so I'll go 33. So you put your prices out and you're 33. By the time I'd done my prices, there might be two other firms out with prices. One's 25 and one's 28. So I've gone 33. Obviously, this time on a Monday, Betfair doesn't have as liquid a market. I would never look at it when I put my prices out originally. And suddenly you're top price at 33. And then you'll see some punters or tipsters or bloggers, he's their number one pick or their headline pick. What I would say to those people and to those punters, and everyone does it their own way, but this guy was 100-1 last week and he's in a similar field. And I factored in, I already know all those things, that you say that when you're doing your write-ups, whether it's in the, you know, media or online, and you're putting in all those factors, I've already put them in as well. I know all those as well. That's why he's 33-1 and not 100-1. My question to them would be, what price do you make him to be putting him up at 33? If you make him 20, then fair enough. But I think a great thing for punters and just a normal punters to do was price things up yourself. You price it up, you know, it's not a smoke and mirrors thing. Literally, you'll be surprised once you start doing it, whatever it is, football, tennis, golf, horse racing, start pricing things up yourself and you'll be surprised once you've done it a few times how easy it is and how, you know, more proficient you become at it. And you will, I guarantee you'll become a better punter for doing it.
Because there's a lot of people, like I said before, interested in golf betting. So a lot of the firms are getting very competitive to get those customers in. And you see up to like 10 places for a golf tournament. How many places would start getting, it's a bit 50-50 whether it's still in your favour or not. How, you know, how far can they, should a punter start stepping in when he sees a certain amount of places
being
let?
How many places do I think before it starts becoming bad value for a bookmaker? Five? You know, I remember the first time we went from a quarter of the odds, the first four to the first five. It was on the week of the Open, and it was a decision I'd made with my trading director at the time. The week before, we used to bet at the Scottish Open at Loch Lomond. We'd had dinner there one evening, and I said, you know, why don't we try and go extra place next week? And we waited till Hills and Corals had printed their coupons of a quarter of the four that were going to be in the shops on the Monday. And then we went a quarter to the five, and it was a headline page on the back page of the Racing Post, Ladbrokes take plunge. You know, it seemed ridiculous now to think that going five places was headline news, but amongst the big bookmakers at the time it was. Now, you see, I reckon if you went to every trading firm, every firm in the country, and asked the odds compilers or the traders what they think about going 10 places, I can guarantee you what their answers would be. You know, that's got nothing to do with trading. It's got nothing to do with bookmaking. It's got everything to do with marketing and PR and acquisition of new customers. You can't make money as a... If it's your intention to make a winning book on the Open or the Masters by going 10 places, you've literally got no chance whatsoever. As a bookmaker, you used to drive me mad because I used to... I was very much, that's my money. Even though it was the company's money, I viewed it as, that's my money you're taking. And I really felt like that. And for 50 weeks of the year, when you're working as hard as you can to try and make your figures add up, your profit and loss add up to make a good book, and then for 2 weeks of the year, it was sort of taken out of your hands and, well, we're going eight places or we're going seven places. I think most recently it's been noticed that I think punters might have suffered slightly because whereas firms would be betting over broke by 300, 400, 500% on the place book, I think the win book for some of the recent tournaments where extra places have been offered has the percentages have gone up from, you know, 130, 140, 150, 160, 170. So the margins on the win book is suffering because you're trying to protect the place book all the time. It's great for punters ultimately with all these places, but I don't, you know, it's a race to the bottom of the sea for me.
Okay, and finally on golf, you bet in play. So yes. Was that part of your remit to price up in play?
Yeah, I used to bet in play. You know, eventually as everyone became more specialised, we had people that just did that, and I just tend to bet in play on the bigger tournaments. All you're really doing then is trying to, I thought golf was the hardest tournament, the hardest sport to bet in play on as a trader. Because if you're betting in play on the football or the tennis or the snooker, you can see the ball. You can see the ball the whole time. The whole 90 minutes of the game, you can see the ball. At golf, you know, there's 80 balls in play and you can only ever see one of them. That's what I used to tell my trading director when I did some money in any of us. It's the hardest sport in the business to try and bet on in play. It is difficult. You're constantly trying to battle against the leaderboard and, you know, someone's had an eagle, someone's had a birdie. When we first started doing it, I used to travel around all the courses in the country. When you used to have like 8 or 10 tournaments in this country at St Melian and Woburn and Wentworth in the Forest of Arden and Hanbury Manor and St Pierre in Chepstow, we used to actually go around to the courses. It was great fun at the time because you used to get bookmakers on the course as well. And this was when you had to pay tax in the betting shops. Because the bookmakers set up on the courses were deemed on course, it was NT, so you used to get all sorts of shenanigans and sharks and that standing in front of the leaderboard, running in and out to the betting shop. on those great big brick mobile phones that you had to have a thing. Yeah, great fun to be there, and you know, really enjoyable time to do it. But you were literally relying on teletext and someone at the course ringing the scores back to you, you making the changes, ringing them to the studio or ringing someone there. 10 minutes between someone having a birdie and changing the price. But now, obviously, you've just got to be very much on the ball. Maybe it's a younger man's game.
Okay, so finally on that, in the current medium, the current sort of state of affairs, is it a good medium for punters? Have they got a chance of making it pay?
Well, absolutely, because as I've said before, someone is trying to keep on top of numerous markets and numerous you know, players and numerous things out on the course, and you've only got to try and find one or two bits and pieces of value. So, you know, the fact that things are on TV now all the time gives you a great opportunity, and you're nothing that isn't available to you as a punter is available to the bookmaker. So you're watching it, in the same time they are. They've not got a faster feed on the cricket than you're watching the cricket, you know. They're not got some 20 people at the golf course telling them what's going on, everyone. They're watching the same pictures that you are. And you can pick and choose where you bet, you know. So it's great for punters at the moment, absolutely, yeah.
Customer management. Now that's something that's a bit of a bone of contention with a lot of people. You go on Twitter, everybody wins.
Yeah.
They've all been restricted. Nobody can get a bet. What is the reality of it?
Well, it's a big part of, you know, it is a big part of any major firm now. I think that the time I realised how much it had become a factor and how much it was changing was when there were more people employed within the trading room dealing with customer accounts and monitoring business, and they were actually setting the odds. I think that was kind of like the tipping point where it was, there is a lot more markets, there's a lot more business. You know, you want to, I think a lot of the time people imagine that people are just cut arbitrarily because of, you know, we don't like them or they're winners. I can understand why people feel like that, and I'm certainly not going to say there aren't people who've just had one or two bets who have had their accounts restricted. But quite often when you look at it, it's because they've got six accounts or they've bet on something that's, you know, been put up the wrong way around. So, you know, it's been put up 6-4 instead of 4-6 or something like that. And a lot of those people have their accounts restricted. It's because of some, let's say, nefarious activity. I don't think it's as rife as you would believe from the people. I think people only complain when they've had a bad, it's like you go on TripAdvisor and look at a restaurant review. People are more likely to complain when they've had a bad meal than write something up when they've had a good meal. I think that's a lot of the way with social media that's the case. I'm not saying it doesn't go on, of course it does, because it's a huge business, and any business you were in, you know, it'd be remiss of you and your shareholders if you weren't doing the best and that you could to optimise the business for yourselves. In the same way that any customer can go and bet with any bookmaker, you know, they're not restricted to having to bet with one firm. Should it be the case that every bookmaker has to lay every customer?
Okay, so there's another thing I was interested in, trading tools. Briefly tell us what trading tools are.
Yeah, algorithmic programs that people design, that quants design, and so that you can run multiple events rather than just who's going to win the match. So on football, for example, you couldn't possibly, if you were trading it, run 200 markets yourself. But using a trading tool, it can update as long as it knows how long's been played and as long as it knows what the score is and as long as it can be told if it's a penalty or a free kick, or it can then develop next corner markets, throw-ins, bookings, time of goals, etc. You can, you know, it can do 200 markets that you couldn't do if you were trying to do them on your own.
Okay, and liability management. Don't bookies just stand everything they get?
No, I can't speak for all bookmakers. I was never one, I never wanted to hedge something. I was always very much of, I'm only laying it because I think it's the right price. If I don't think it's the right price, what am I laying it for anyway? And I wasn't one who would look at their field book and adjust the prices necessarily off of the field book, because you can't change anything that's in your field book. All those bets that are already in there, whatever it is, you've already laid them. So by changing the price on it now, you're not affecting any of those bets that are already in there. So I wouldn't look at a book and say, I hated the phrase, we can afford to lay this, or this suits the book. Every bet suits the book if it's at the right price. No bet suits the book if it's at the wrong price. So if you're the wrong price, why are you the wrong price? I'd much more that the only price you need to be right is the next one you lay. You can't do anything about the ones you already laid. So make sure that the prices that you've got on display for whatever it might be, a horse race or a golf tournament or a tennis match, make sure the prices you've got up so the next bet that comes through on the ticker is at the right price. I think there's been some incredible bad trading from firms trying to green up their books, as it's called, or to balance their books. Don't take the bets in the first place if the prices are wrong.
Okay, talk about prices being wrong. Something else that used to be incredibly popular, anti-post betting, seems to be something not that encouraged anymore. Would you say that's true, and if so, why?
If you're specifically talking about horses...
In this instance.
Yeah, I don't think it ever was as popular as you might lead it to believe. Its popularity as far as a PR tool and as far as, you know, so-and-so's been cut for Cheltenham or for the Guineas was newspaper, it was something to get on the front page of the paper. It was something to get a quote somewhere from, you know, Mike Dillon or whoever it might be. The actual amount of business you would take anti-post on the 2,000 Guineas, you would take more on the first race at Newton Abbott that was on the same day. You know, it's never anything more than that. But it's good for punters if you've got a chance. Who doesn't want to be on a 20-1 chance that's going off at 2-1? So I think from an interest point of view, from a punter's interest, and for keeping the interest in the sport going, I think, yeah, it is what it is. It's a great medium. I don't think it's any more or less now turnover-wise. You get to the first race at Cheltenham and you'd take more on the first race at Cheltenham on the day than you would anti-post on all of the races in Cheltenham leading up to the festival.
Okay, so you've priced up the Derby, and somebody comes on for a well-bred but unraced 2-year-old for the next year's Derby, wants a monkey on at 50-1. Are you inclined to take it or bluff it?
It's depended on who the customer was, really. You know, if it's not been raced before, and invariably someone's coming on for that sort of bet, I'd take it if it's a year away. But, you know, you're almost paying for that information then at the same time, aren't you? Could be, if it's someone connected with the horse, you know, trainer, owner, breeder or whatever, then yeah, you'd definitely take it because you want them to come to you to give you that sort of privileged little bit of information, I suppose. But, equally for having said that it's not a great medium for huge amounts of business, there'd be very few times you'd ever win any money as a bookmaker anti-post. It really was like a shop window. You'd inevitably end up with the first two or three in the front of the market in the Guineas all being losers in the book or whatever race it might be, and then you're just hoping for a result on the day.
Right, so you need to be able to monetize the information that you've paid 500 quid for and potentially a lot more than that for.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Okay, so you've been talking for this interview about, you know, your skills at pricing up events. You've been doing it for a long time, very successfully, so you must be a pretty good punter.
I used to be a reasonable punter, yeah, sort of 20 odd years ago, when, like I say, I thought I knew more than I had more information than everyone else did, kind of thing. One of those that sticks in my mind was a Formula One Grand Prix in America. We had a great guy called Roger Toll who did our F1 odds, and word had leaked through that there was a problem with the tyres. Some of the teams were Bridgestone and some of them were Michelin. And I think it was, guys, 15 years ago, something like that. And it leaked through that the teams were going to run the race, but after the end of the practice lap, 20 of the riders were going to pull straight into the pit lane and finish the race before they'd even gone out because there was a safety issue with the tyres. So Roger had picked up on this and he told me. So there were the two Ferraris, Barrichello and Schumacher, two Jordans and two Minardis. They'd be the only six that were racing. Schumacher and Barrichello were 4-5 and 5-2. The two Jordans were 1,000-1. The two Minardis were 2,500-1. So I backed the two Jordans each way at 1,000-1. So they've gone off on the start lap, all the cars have gone off. 20 of them have pulled in after the first warm-up lap. Just 6 of them have gone out. Schumacher's gone off. Barrichello's gone off. They're a lap ahead of the two Jordans. The two Jordans were a lap ahead of the two Minardi. So all I need is one of these two Jordans to finish third, and I've drawn my 1,000 to 1 each way. They managed to avoid crashing into each other, thankfully, and they did. The race is finished. I said to Roger, God, that's 1,000 to 1 each way. You know, had the right touch here, sort of thing. Then there's lots of stewards' inquiries. Is anyone paying out? Are we going to avoid bets? Because we were aware of it, we were going to settle it as was the race. The firm I'd had my bet with, through my wife's name, was a company called Blue Square, who are sadly no longer with us. Their trading director phoned up our office to speak to Roger, because he was the F1 guy. Says, well, what are you doing? Are you paying out or whatever? And I'm sort of on Roger's shoulder saying, tell him we're paying out, tell him we're paying. We paid out, so they paid out. Money went straight into my wife's account. I won like $6,000 or something like that. But then I didn't actually get paid again, because she kept the money and said, that's for the wedding. So it was one of my better results, but I never actually got paid off of it in the end anyway. I used to punt. It became impossible to get bets on, because obviously, you know, everyone knew who I was, and I wasn't a big punter, you know, £100 would be a big bet for me, sort of thing. And I probably never had a bet for 10 years, and I just started again a couple of years ago, but recreational, I punt, like, now I punt on Ascot and Cheltenham, and the TV race on the Saturday, a couple of £100 on the golf each week. So I would describe myself as, you know, a bet on the football on Saturday or the TV game, a typical what you would want as a bookmaker, recreational gambler, but with a little bit of knowledge.
I was going to say, it wouldn't be in your be against your genes to just have a guess up, wouldn't it?
I don't have a guess up, no. You know, I'm a Watford season ticket holder, so I know a little bit about Watford. So I would have a bet on, you know, first player to be booked or something like that, or once I saw team news and that. So I'm not anything that anyone in the high street wouldn't know about, and obviously I know a bit about golf, so I'll pick out who I fancy and have a couple of bets each week, but not to a serious extent, to an extent where I enjoy it and it adds to my enjoyment of the thing, and hopefully I manage to, you know, win a few quid along the way as well.
So you're not working as a trader at the moment?
No.
Not a trader, sorry, an odds compiler?
Yeah, no, my tenure at Ladbrokes Coral GVC, as it became, ended last year after just under 33 years. It might seem strange to say it was the right time to move on, having been somewhere for so long, but the opportunity came for, they were very generous to me when I left, you know. I wouldn't hear anything said against them as a company, or, you know, they looked after me very well, and it just seemed the right time. My son was finishing his A-levels, he was going to be off for a long time before he went to uni. My daughter had finished her GCSEs, it was time to take couple of holidays with the family and enjoy some time away together and relax a little bit, and I've kind of done that now, and hopefully, yeah, I might start to look to find my way back into something. I think I've probably still got 10 years in me or something like that before they push me off into the odds compiler's sunset retirement home.
Well, this is the last thing then. You've obviously, well, I assume you're still a bit of a tank left, so have you not considered going all in and going professional punting?
Yes, I have. Obviously, then you get to the point where it all becomes a little bit more serious if you're using it as a livelihood. And then I think the difficulty of getting on becomes a factor. But because, you know, I'm having £50 or £100 on something, it's not difficult for me to get bets on at the moment. So I think it has crossed my mind, and, you know, it's crossed my wife's mind. And my daughter says to me, what do I tell my friends you do for a living, Dad, if they ask me? And she likes to tell them I'm a professional punter, but I wouldn't call it very professional. It's an option, it's a possibility, but at the moment, you know, enjoying things as they are, so long may it continue.
Great stuff. Well, Brad Barry, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us, and good luck.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can follow Star Sports on Twitter at @StarSports_bet, our Facebook page at @StarSportsBet, and also view all our latest videos on YouTube at Star Sports. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.